Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. Many Christians have been taught that the goal of our faith is to simply leave earth and go up to heaven. But what if that's not the full story? In his remarkable book, God's Homecoming, N.T. Wright traces the sweeping biblical promise that God is not abandoning this world, he is renewing it. From Genesis to Revelation, Scripture tells the story not of us going up to God, but of God coming down to dwell with us. We're offering you a free digital excerpt so you can explore this hope-filled vision for yourself. Download it today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to have a guest and friend on the show, which is Justin Brierley. How are you, Justin?
Very well, thank you. Nice to see you both.
For those who haven't come across your work, could you just spend a little bit about what you do? You're yourself a veteran podcaster yourself, so talk a little bit about what you do, what you produce, what you're doing, what you're up to these days.
Well, of course, for many years, I was heading up Unbelievable, which is the one of the podcasts that Matters of Life and Death now finds itself part of the stable of from Premier Unbelievable. So many people, I'm sure, who do listen to this might know me from my 17 plus years of hosting the Unbelievable radio show, podcast and so on, which was a huge privilege to be able to do that, bringing Christians and non-Christians together over nearly two decades. But I've been basically involved in Christian journalism of some kind for over 20 years now. In more recent years, since moving on from Premier, I went on to publish a book called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, really looking at the way the conversations on faith have changed in the past two decades. And what I sensed was a turning of the tide when it came to a renewal of interest in Christian faith, even among, you know, secular intellectuals and so on. And then sort of being able to chart that in real time through the Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God podcast documentary series, which really looked at that thesis, kind of told it narratively, but also looked at some of the interesting new things, manifestations of it that seem to have been happening in the last couple of years, which I imagine we'll talk about today. And just most recently, kind of returning to the moderator's chair again for a new show called Uncommon Ground, which is available on video and podcast over at my website, justinbrierley.com. And that's me back in with my first love, you could say, of bringing Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. And we've had some fantastic first episodes with people like Richard Dawkins and Rowan Williams in conversation, Alex O'Connor, very well-known YouTube atheist opposite Christian thinker Glenn Scrivener. So, yeah, really, really pleased with the launch of that new show too.
Brilliant. Well, you're very much kind of finger on the pulse of this conversation, as you said. What you've been calling the surprising rebirth. Sometimes people talk about the idea of the quiet revival, which came out of some different research last year. But one of the kind of common threads I think people often say is that for much of Christian history, at least in the West, church has been perceived to have a preponderance of women coming to church. And yet some people say that might be shifting with this new kind of cultural move, and that to everyone's surprise, more men than women seem to be responding to the rebirth. What kind of data, how quantifiable is that? Or is that just a kind of a vibe?
Well, I think for me, it was a vibe. When I wrote The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, I sensed actually a lot of young men who were seemed dissatisfied with their life and were shifting from listening to those new atheist figures like Dawkins, Harris and Hitchens of 10 or 15 years ago to suddenly being open to different answers, different responses from people like Jordan Peterson and others who we might come on to discuss. But it was all anecdotal at that point from my point of view, but I was definitely sensing there's a more of an openness among these kind of young men who I've traditionally bumped into as quite hardened atheists. They now seem to be interested agnostics, you know, at least. But then, of course, yeah, we did have some really surprising data coming out over the last couple of years, as I said, that sort of has seemed to lend some hard statistical evidence to what I sensed was happening. So, I mean, just to start with, the first thing I started to hear about was statistics coming out of parts of Europe, especially in sort of the Norway, Sweden, Finland, places like that. A number of studies seemed to show an uptick in the number of young men taking interest in faith, coming to church and that kind of thing. So that was intriguing and interesting. I noticed a number of other markers happening across other parts of Europe and the West, a kind of booming Catholicism over the last couple of years, especially in places like France and Spain. A number of people reporting large numbers of young men sort of entering Eastern Orthodoxy, interestingly, and that kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, about a year ago, as of the time we're recording this, we had the Quiet Revival research from Bible Society, which, you know, was very surprising in its way, seeming to show a real increase between 2018 and 2024 in these YouGov surveys they did, in terms of the numbers of people generally saying they're attending church, but especially among that young age demographic, 18 to 24, went up from about 4% saying they went to church somewhat regularly to 16%. But if you just counted the young men, not just the women, you would find that they were saying it was about 21%, you know, a sort of fivefold increase. So quite extraordinary figures. Now, it's worth saying that those figures have been disputed since. There's been an interesting back and forth in the newspapers and the media about, you know, this Quiet Revival research. And, you know, in my own Surprising Rebirth podcast series at the end of the last season, we did a really deep dive into that, interviewing the co-author of the report, Rhiannon McAleer, opposite one of its key critics, David Vose. So I think there's an interesting discussion to be had, because there is conflicting data as well from things like the British Social Attitude Survey. Nevertheless, I'm convinced overall that the Bible Society have put their finger on something that's happening. Now, the specifics of the data will get nuanced, I'm sure. But when you combine it with everything else I've been seeing, the other data points that I've already mentioned, others that could be mentioned, like the huge spike in Bible sales, you know, across the West, it feels like something's happening. And specifically, it seems a lot of the action seems to be located in these young men. And again, I was anecdotally just hearing from church leaders up and down the UK saying, we're just seeing a lot of young men suddenly turning up at the doors of our church, often clutching a Bible that they've only recently purchased, perhaps coming in because they've been influenced by some kind of social media thing, sometimes quite politicized, and that's worth us talking about as well. But yeah, hungry, you know, sort of spiritually searching. And so, and I've seen that as well. I've met a lot of these young men, and I'm prepared to say it's definitely not just a kind of anecdotal thing. I do think there's a real sense that young men are on a journey, and a number of them are finding their way to church.
Yeah, and I think we all sense this. There's a difference in the vibe, and I'd be very interested, just, you know, to trace some of the historical, you know, progression. You know, going back quite a long way to the 1950s. You know, when Billy Graham first came to the UK, there were those meetings in the Haringey Stadium, which we used to live just around the corner there. I used to go to Sainsbury's and often think that this is kind of holy ground, because it was actually on this site that many hundreds of people became Christians in the 1950s. And it was said that back in the 1950s, it was possible for your average kind of person to go to a Billy Graham service and with absolutely no faith, no nothing at all, and 2 hours later they are making a genuine step of faith. And all the evidence shows, of course not everybody that went forward, but in fact so many people who subsequently became very significant figures in the British Protestant and Evangelical Church traced their origins to a Billy Graham. So, and yet, so once you get into the 60s and the 70s, clearly there's then this massive shift and a kind of move against traditional religion. And I've often thought of that in terms of the acids of modernity, you know, this sort of deconstruction of all the foundations. And then you get into the new atheists, who are almost like the further development. So that before you, any young person could seriously consider becoming a Christian, you've got all these barriers, you know, because, you know, science has disproved God, because, you know, God is just a patriarchal, homophobic, misogynistic, etc., racist. And you've got to overcome all those barriers before anyone could seriously engage with what genuine New Testament Christianity is putting forward.
Yeah, I've recognised everything you're describing there. I mean, I think it's interesting going back to the Billy Graham 1950s rallies and the just the extraordinary response that we saw in what was a fairly conservative sort of way of doing things in the UK. This, you know, quite flashy, you know, American evangelist turns up, and I don't think anyone quite expected him to have the impact he had, but he did. And I think partly one of the reasons I think Billy Graham saw such fruit in the 50s especially was because this was obviously the post-war period, and I think there was a real sense that two world wars had kind of really created the grounds for people needing hope, purpose, meaning after, you know, these two world wars had just destabilized everything and kind of led to so many, I think, you know, had probably created the conditions under which not just the Billy Grahams, but the C.S. Lewis's and others had kind of been able to speak into an environment where people were looking, you know, for hope and purpose again. And Bishop Graham Tomlin is one of the ones who's pointed out that in an overall sort of story of decline over the sort of last 200 years or so in the UK, you did see an interesting sort of upturn in baptisms and confirmations in the Anglican Church after the war. And I think it's because it was one of those moments when everything got shaken and people often look to faith and Christianity and church as a sort of stabilizing thing. Now, I think you could fast forward to today and say, in its own way, I think this, whatever this surprising rebirth, quiet revival thing is, it's got some similarities to that, because I think we are also living through a time of massive change that is quite destabilizing for a lot of people. It's just that the conditions for that aren't necessarily two world wars. So, you know, who knows what the future holds. But the point is, we've had a major COVID pandemic that completely kind of changed the way everyone had to act and think for quite a while. We've also had a huge, you know, digital social media revolution that's completely changing the way we interact with each other and think about ourselves. And those two things, and you could add many more besides, are kind of creating the conditions under which people are ready. Suddenly, they don't feel as secure in the kind of the liberal cultural sort of milieu that we once promised would give you security and a flourishing life. Suddenly everything's up in the air again, and we have got, you know, war on the edge of Europe, and we have got, you know, a cost of living crisis, and we have got a lot of young people especially feeling like they've been disenfranchised and they're not reaping the benefits that their parents, you know, the Gen X or Boomer generation had, and so on. So all of these, I think, contribute to why we're seeing, you know, what we're seeing today. You have, as you said, you've had that period in the 60s and 70s of deconstruction, postmodernism and everything else. But I think it's almost postmodernism has started to eat itself. And I think that's what we're experiencing in the kind of just the way in which social media has accelerated that postmodern trend to a degree where people have realized we can't live like this anymore, where we just, everything's up for grabs, you can completely reinvent yourself at the drop of a hat. I think that is actually exhausting, burdensome, and is part of the reason there's a mental health crisis among young people. And so I think, again, it's one of those conditions, the postmodern thing, in a sense, by reaching its zenith in the social media age, has actually created the conditions for people to say, this isn't working. We need to look for older answers. And again, I think that's partly why people are suddenly open to suddenly new characters coming on the scene saying, there is this old book that just so happens might be the cultural touchstone and foundation of everything we've come to value in the West, might be worth taking a second look at. And yeah, I think that's a significant part of the story.
Are those two, because we've touched on almost two different streams there. So you have the kind of disaffected young person, particularly men, who feel like, you know, society isn't working for them. They're kind of cut adrift, you know, maybe struggling for regular employment, feeling like the prospects of the future are poor and like open and ready to kind of find an alternative source of meaning. But then you also have maybe a different stream, which you've been really involved in tracking, which is that kind of intellectual elite level, the kind of post Tom Holland thesis of actually, it turns out our entire culture is built on Christian thinking. And I already believe all these things. And therefore, it's a small leap to then go from saying, I already have all these values that I discover are Christian values. Maybe I should go and explore this person, Christ. Are those two independent streams, do you think? Or do you see those two kind of roots back into church overlapping in some way?
Massively overlapping, for sure. Because the reality is, you know, Tom Holland's thesis about the way in which Christianity has completely shaped our moral imagination in the West, it's not exactly new. That others had said similar things over the years. Why did that thesis become so resonant, though, just in the last few years with so many people, not just Christians who kind of, yay, we've got someone on our side, but also a lot of non-Christians and secular people, you know, essentially, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was arguably the most famous female atheist in the world, when she had her, you know, conversion to Christianity in late 2023, the intellectual sort of foundations for that was becoming convinced by the Tom Holland thesis that only the Christian story can sustain the kinds of values that we cherish in the West. Why has it become so resonant for people like her and many others now? I think it's because we've reached a point in our post-Christian culture where that sea of faith has gone out so far, and I owe this particular metaphor to Glenn Scrivener, really, where it's revealed, as it were, how much of the things we take for granted are, in fact, have been shaped by the Christian story. I think when there was still a kind of enough of a kind of sense of cultural Christianity around, that was still the prevailing kind of mindset and paradigm, you didn't notice too much, actually, that the things you believed in are fundamentally Christian in nature. I think it's once other worldviews start to become more predominant or rivals to the Christian worldview that you start to realize, there is actually something that gave us these particular values. And so in Ayaan Hirsi Ali's case, you know, she specifically talks about fundamentalist Islam as being an alternative worldview that is kind of on offer now to some extent in the West. And a lot of people thinking, that's a very different way of looking at life and what it means to be human to the one I'm used to. Why do I believe that there's a better way of doing that? Or the kind of very, you know, uber progressive left, kind of what's sometimes pejoratively called woke ways of looking at culture. And again, for those who feel like, no, this has gone too far, this is a sort of, to some extent, dehumanizing or whatever. Why does that not feel right? You know, why are we worried about communist China or, Russia wanted to take over the world? These are all worldviews that are now appearing on our timeline, and I think it's sort of been a wake-up call, I think, to a lot of people to realize atheism, secularism, the materialist worldview that sort of has come to be the background noise of the academy and our culture, it doesn't have answers to why these other worldviews are not the ones we should embracing. The answers are given, at least, are very unsatisfactory. I think what Tom Holland has done a really good job of reminding his secular peers is that atheist humanism, to the extent that anyone really believes, you know, holds that, I think it's a tiny minority anyway, is really just a kind of godless version of Protestantism. It's very easy to see the way in which all of the things that kind of secular humanism believes in have essentially been borrowed from the Christian tradition. And it's easier to see that now because as the Sea of Faith draws back, it reveals the contours of the kinds of beliefs we have and why they are so distinctive compared to these other worldviews that are around. So that's my kind of take on that. And I think, yes, it definitely links into this search for meaning, this meaning crisis that we're seeing, especially among young people, especially among young men. They're kind of saying, well, what they're looking around at the alternatives on offer and saying, It turns out this Christian story has a lot more going for it than my parents or grandparents gave it credit for, you know, and it's leading a lot of them to sort of investigate it again.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. But I just like to add to those worldviews the kind of techno-utopian worldview, which is, you know, very, very strong at the moment and current in Silicon Valley and in the tech world. But this, again, is based on a physicalist infrastructure, which is actually a kind of, I've heard it described as a soft nihilism, because it says there is ultimately no meaning, there's just physics. And in a world of physics, it's quite hard to see what's special about being human. And in particular, you know, if we're no longer the most intelligent species on the planet, you know, human extinctionism starts to become something actually intellectually credible and defensible. And so there is a genuine movement towards human extinctionism, you know, with the idea that we're going to be replaced by machines. And again, you know, people say, hang on a minute, you know, is this what we bought into when I opened ChatGPT or got my smartphone? So it's another example, I think, of a powerful worldview, which is now creating a resistance, and people say, it can't be right.
Yeah, I do think the kind of the techno sort of bros utopia sort of thing, it's an extension in a way, I think, of the new atheists. I think a lot of the new atheists put their faith in science, technology, reason as, you know, being the tools for building ourselves a better world. But I think the problem is they've never had a foundation to say what better equals, why we would preference the human over any other form of life or indeed non-life that may emerge beyond us. So I think there's been a sort of a blithe kind of rushing onwards to kind of, you know, as though just progress for progress sake, we'll you know, and we'll work it out as we go along. I think increasingly we're fast learning the lessons that just putting in more science and technology and reason without any kind of foundational meaning or value behind it is actually a recipe for disaster. You know, it's actually very dehumanizing. We suddenly realize that there are reasons why humans are built the way we are, that we're meant to live with a certain amount of community. We have certain limitations, and there's a reason why we exist within those limitations that are good for us. And so I think we're fast learning just what happens when, basically, when you dispense with God, you know, and put ourselves in the place of God and kind of assume that basically we can do what we like with technology, and how quickly that runs away into, you know, all of the things that C.S. Lewis, you know, so well kind of prophesied in books like The Abolition of Man and That Hideous Strength and so on. It feels like it's all just coming true right now, doesn't it? You know, in all kinds of weird ways.
One of the kind of fascinating questions I'd love to probe into with you, Justin, is you sometimes hear some Christians acting a bit concerned about this kind of influx of new interest or even new believers into the church. You know, you mentioned people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and I know some people read her kind of essay, Why I Am Now a Christian, and said, there's not very much here about Jesus or the Bible. There's a lot here about the church as a kind of cultural bulwark against Marxism, atheism, China and Islam. But is the church being kind of turned into a kind of functional thing, that Christianity is a kind of, people are retreating Christianity for political reasons as a kind of cultural bulwark? You know, you have a lot of that conversation about people being skeptical about someone like Tommy Robinson in this country and his conversion. This is actually not really about Jesus and life-giving, transforming faith. This is about a kind of traditionalism, a retrograde step. And Christians are a bit too credulous to kind of welcome in anyone who says, I'll take the label because actually I want the kind of cultural accretion that goes with it.
Yeah, I share all of those concerns that you've mentioned. And especially in the second season of Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God podcast, we really dig into that whole thing. In fact, we started the season last year with two episodes titled Is the Rebirth Right Wing? Because absolutely, there's an obvious overlap between a lot of the people who are saying we need Christian values are good for our culture, and people who are wanting to co-opt that fact for a particular political project and are arguably less interested in the Christ, more interested in the, you know, quote unquote Christendom. And the problem, of course, is that you don't get Christendom. Well, Christendom is a happy byproduct of people who followed Christ and lived out his teachings and the way it transformed the world around them. But if you just aim at the values, just aim at Christendom, you're going to get something very idolatrous and non-Christian, actually, that is, and it's putting the cart before the horse. And I had similar concerns about Ian Hersey's, Ali's, you know, essay. It was primarily kind of written from a sort of cultural, political standpoint. I understand why a lot of critics said this is more of a political conversion, if it's anything. Having said that, she did go on to give some quite personal interviews afterwards about a personal meaning crisis she had. So I think the essay was like sketching out the intellectual foundations for why she'd come to believe atheism does not offer adequate answers to how cultures flourish. She believes Christianity does. But I think the reason she felt so confident to say that was because she'd also been on this personal journey, which she talked about quite movingly, where she'd experienced a personal meaning crisis, nihilism, alcoholism, just not being able to make sense as an atheist of purpose and meaning. And it was only when, you know, one of her counsellors finally said, "I think you're spiritually bankrupt. Have you tried praying?" And she said, "Well, I couldn't pray. You know, the God I was raised with in Islam was a monster." That this counsellor said, "Well, what kind of God might you be willing to believe in?" And as she started to kind of play along and describe that kind of God, she realised she was essentially describing Jesus Christ. And so that prompted her to start praying and going to church. And in her own words, you know, God completely turned her life upside down. So I'm really happy to take that at face value and believe that there has been a genuine, you know, encounter and spiritual transformation on Ian Hersey Ali's side. Now, she's still obviously very invested in the culture wars and in the political dimension of all of this. She's still an activist in a sense, though I do think, I do sense that in the conversations I've seen her having and that I've had briefly with her, there's a sense in which the game has changed for her because she believes in Christ now, because there's something else, if you like, at the centre of that. But having said that, there's still a huge danger, you know, whether it's her or many others in this whole area of essentially, yeah, co-opting Christianity and this new interest in faith for a particular political project. And of course, we need to be very wary of that. We need to understand that if the gospel is true, it has to, in some sense, transcend political categories. It has to transcend even particular cultural instantiations. You know, Jesus didn't come to bring us Western culture. He came to bring us life in all its fullness. And that can be experienced in actually quite a few different ways and manifestations of across time and history. It's a mixed bag, is what I'm saying. But wouldn't you expect that, I suppose? I suppose it, for me, that is completely to be expected because we're very human. And every time, you know, there's an opportunity for God to be working in the hearts and minds of people, there are people who want to use that for other purposes. You see, it's all across the New Testament, you know, when the early churches, there's all kinds of other actors coming in, sort of trying to pull believers this way and that way for their own particular purposes. But that doesn't negate the fact something's happening. You know, I do truly believe there is a spiritual hunger that's at root here. But we need to be very careful, as innocent as doves, as wise as serpents, when it comes to how we respond. Because it's so easy for these things to go down dead ends and wrong turns. And for Christians themselves to sort of, yeah, as you said, Tim, just kind of say, "Oh, isn't it all wonderful?" and baptize things that really shouldn't be baptized with Christian faith, you know.
We often hear that science has made belief in God unnecessary, but has it? This month, we're offering an exclusive ebook titled Beyond the Cosmos: Physics, Philosophy, and the God Question, drawn from two compelling, unbelievable dialogues that explores cosmic fine-tuning, the limits of scientific explanation, the Kalam argument, reductionism, morality, and even questions about time and extraterrestrial life. It's thoughtful, rigorous, and refreshingly even-handed. When you give support to Premier Insight, we'll send you this ebook as our thank you. Visit premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to request your copy today. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Just reflecting on it, you know, going back to the new atheists like Dawkins, I mean, you know, Dawkins famously sort of perpetrated the idea that that people, anybody who believed this superstitious rubbish was just thick. I mean, no sort of right-thinking, intelligent person could possibly believe this rubbish. And then what we have is a whole series of really quite remarkably bright and intelligent and clearly well-educated people who are making that shift. I mean, I was just thinking about another influential figure, Louise Perry, again, coming from a very different and radical feminist perspective, and is again clearly on a journey, and you know, and she's talked about how she buys the philosophy, she has difficulty with the metaphysics, as she puts it.
I mean, interestingly, with Louise, in some of the most recent conversations I've seen her in, she is now calling herself a Christian and has said, you know, it's not that she doesn't have any doubts or there's no mystery for her in it, but she's just come to see it as the best story to kind of invest herself in. And but what's interesting with her, and I think I see this with a lot of other people, is she did start at the kind of more utility end of this, because it was her experience of starting to change her mind about sexuality, relationships, marriage, that kind of thing. She'd, as you say, grown up with a much more kind of typical liberal, you know, feminist mindset, until she started working in a rape crisis centre after university and seeing the way that actually the sexual revolution had not been good for everyone, especially for women and children. And she just went on this very academic, you know, project of starting to chart that in a PhD that eventually became her book, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, just looking, you know, just in a purely socio-evolutionary way, the way in which the sexual revolution had actually had all kinds of negative consequences for people. And to her surprise, discovering in the process that there was this fuddy-duddy old institution that had actually put guardrails on male sexuality, had allowed for the flourishing of women, children and families, and in turn cultures and nations. And it was this funny old institution called monogamous Christian marriage. And in a sense, it was that realization, purely kind of, you know, as I say, not she never wrote that book, you know, as a Christian or with any kind of faith perspective exactly, but it sort of triggered something, I think, in her, which said maybe evidently Christianity has been quite useful, it turns out. And that led her to wonder, I wonder if it could be true. She found herself sort of going on that journey that I think I see a lot of other people like Tom Holland and many others going on, often sort of struggling to make the leap because, as she put it in an interview to me, you know, her disenchanted mind is struggles so much with the, as you say, the supernatural aspects. But as with her, as with Tom Holland, as with a number of others I've spoken to, they've kind of just said, you know what, at the end of the day, we've got to believe a story about reality. And I kind of, on the balance of all the evidence in the end, I find I'd much rather believe the Christian story. And so something like that's sort of what faith is. It's never going to be about certainty and having everything wrapped up logically. There's still a lot of paradox and everything else, but it's kind of, it's the best story going, and that's why we trust it. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, people come to faith all sorts of ways, and you see that in scripture, sometimes for quite dubious reasons. You know, I've heard people who became Christians because they fancied a girl in the youth group and they started coming along, and then the talk, you know, started to sink in. That's fine. I guess the question is not kind of, we don't want to put guardrails around the church and say, I'm sorry, you came here through radical feminism or you came here through anti-Islam. You know, that's not the right method into faith. But how should we, who are already Christians, how do we respond to the young men walking in because they've been compelled by a Jordan Peterson 8-hour YouTube series about cleaning their room and now they think they want to explore the God of the Old Testament? You know, like, how do we as the kind of established believers, how do we help them get from whatever led them to interest Christian into a more kind of mainstream Orthodox church Jesus discipleship movement?
I think that is the huge question. It was a question we tried to tackle to some extent at a conference that I hosted with Speak Life and Glenn Scrivener towards the end of last year, called Responding to the Rebirth, and all the material from that is available if you want some kind of quite in-depth kind of panels and speakers on this, because I think that is the real task of the church now. There's an opportunity here, but it's coming at a very interesting cultural moment where, as I said, a lot of these young men are coming in quite politicized, actually, and that's the reality. They're far more like everyone. They're getting a lot more screen time with their influencers and so on in their algorithmic silos than the half an hour they might get in church from a sermon or whatever it is. Now, I'm glad they're at church, though, because I think that's the place they need to be. But firstly, churches definitely need to not be captured by a kind of politicized thing. And sadly, that isn't always true. I think in America, there's large parts of the church that have to some extent been. But how do we hold out something that is truly biblical, that's truly Christ-like? I think it's by going on a journey wherever these young men are coming in, or young women, and saying, we're so glad you're here, but now we want to come alongside you, and we want to sort of show you the fullness of what this is. And that's actually about stopping the... It cannot then just be a case of listening to podcasts, watching, you know, reels and videos. It's got to be done the way it always has been done, in community. And this is the unique thing the Christian church can actually offer. It can't compete with a lot of the, you know, the attention grabbing stuff that's out there on our social media feeds. But what it can do is offer one of the few places where you can still do genuine Christian community. And that's where you actually grow. You don't grow from watching endless reels of Jordan Peterson or whoever. You actually grow when you join a church community and you start to go on a journey together with them. And so that's my hope, is that churches will be up for that. And I think it does require really kind of making ourselves aware through listening to podcasts like yours or mine or whatever of what these cultural dynamics are, so that we're in a position to sort of know, well, why are these young people coming in with these particular views and so on, and how can I best kind of help to not sort of pour cold water on everything, but to kind of help them see this in a bigger frame, in a bigger picture, the way that Jesus Christ speaks to, in a much bigger way, to our needs. So that's my hope and prayer, is that there is fruit to be had here, but we need to do our best in showing people the true picture of Christ.
So one thing I'd really like to explore a bit with you is this idea that there's something about the lack of father figures for so many young men, and that historically, you know, young men growing up, not just in adolescence, but in early adulthood, they need to see older men who represent what masculinity looks like, an attractive model of masculinity, and that all cultures have provided these kind of male role models for young men, and that what is happening is that because of the breakup of families, because of the sort of conflict between generations, and there are so many young men growing up who their biological fathers or their, you know, their communities they're in, education, whatever it is, has not provided role models. And so where are the role models? And also, they're the influencers. That's where I find my role models. And so if these young men are awakening to faith, what it makes me think is there's going to be a huge responsibility for the church to provide alternative older male role models who, and in a way that's what Jordan Peterson was doing, wasn't he? He was providing, in whatever a sort of bizarre way about cleaning your room and so on, he was providing a model of an older man and saying, look, guys, if you want to, you know, get your act together, do we have those male role models in the modern evangelical church?
Well, I hope that we do, because As I said earlier, the church is fast becoming one of the few places where you can find the kind of community that helps to build. And I would say, especially for young men, absolutely, I'd agree with you. They need those kinds of mentors and role models. They're being given very imperfect ones via social media. And obviously, I'd still rather have a Jordan Peterson than an Andrew Tate, for instance, you know, and that's the kind of the alternative. Sadly, I mean, just to cycle back a bit, I think it is both what you described, the fatherlessness of so many in this current generation, and with that, the loss generally, I think, in our culture of many of those rites of passage that typically typified, you know, young men's kind of progression from adolescence to adulthood and so on. We've kind of created the possibility of a kind of eternal adolescence, actually, for a lot of men, and that's a real problem. But I think also you add to that the social media revolution and the very quick progressive advance of all kinds of questions over gender and diversity and everything else. And I think what is already a meaning crisis for a lot of young people in terms of all the plethora of options that are on display becomes very acute, I think, for young men for whom masculinity, you know, is often branded as toxic anyway, and who feel like they sort of have to apologise for being kind of male, basically, to a large degree. Now, rightly or wrongly, I think there's a kind of sense in which a lot of the pushback and the reason a lot of young men have kind of just given up, you know, on the things that society says they should be is because they just feel like, oh, well, I'll never achieve these standards. The goalposts keep moving. And they don't feel like they have anything to hold on to that's a meaningful marker of what it is to be a man and so on. And so sadly you do then have these characters like Andrew Tate coming in and capitalizing on that and kind of speaking into the embittered kind of side of that, you know, it's all the fault of women and it's all the fault of, you know, and so there's a very dark sort of direction in which this, I would say, male identity crisis can head in the West. But there is also a positive thing it can happen, which is that when you've kind of reached the end of your tether, you are willing to look for these fresh answers. And you might find it in some unlikely prophets outside the church, like Jordan Peterson, sort of dispensing quite common sense advice on the face of it. But actually, it sort of being this miraculous life transforming thing for the young men that he meets who come up to him and say, you've changed my life. And I think it's simply giving, sort of handing back the concept of meaning and purpose and identity to young men and saying, you don't have to apologize for who you are, but your masculinity has to be channeled in ways that are productive and life fulfilling and so on. And I think the Christian church is an amazing vehicle for doing that. I think Jesus is an extraordinary model for what true masculinity looks like. Someone who never was married or had sex, but lived this extraordinary life of self-sacrifice and virtue. I think that's a really exciting thing for young men to have modelled to them. And I think it's also why there's a kind of, one of the reasons why in that research that's been coming about Quiet Revival, there is evidently a certain segment of these young men who are looking for a more traditional version of Christian faith that is quite countercultural, that's quite different to what's on offer in the culture. So they might be turning towards Eastern Orthodoxy, which, as well as having the sort of quite ritualized aspects of it, the mystery that maybe, you know, and the re-enchantment that might be drawing some people, it's also quite, you know, demanding in terms of the fasting and the sort of the practices that are involved. And I think young men are kind of looking for that. They want to be told, do it this way, get your life back on track by taking those cold showers, doing the fasting, making a, like, you know, my son with a group from his church has just started on this Exodus 40 course, which has become quite popular among young men, which is a kind of like monastic kind of infused way of structuring your life for 40 days to help you overcome all kinds of negative patterns and the kind of the mindless kind of addiction to social media and all that sort of thing. Because I think young men want to be given some structure again. And I think that's a kind of that for, so for Christians, I think the question is sometimes it's about raising the bar a bit actually, and not just saying, come in, you don't have to change anyway. You don't have to worry too much, just sort of will. I think young people, young men especially, want that sort of challenge because they're tired of just drifting, as is the possibility in the rest of the culture. You know,
I find the kind of gendered aspect of this really fascinating because when I was growing up, you know, 20 years ago, let's say, in the kind of evangelical world, the predominant narrative was that the church was incredibly feminized, that women had kind of overly emasculated Christianity, and that's why the men weren't coming. And there was this whole plethora of movements, Christian Vision for Men, among others, in this country, and I'm sure the same in the States as well, trying to kind of re-ruggedize faith and make it more masculine and muscular, because otherwise, you know, men weren't going to come to these namby-pamby limp-wristed gatherings where we sing Jesus is my boyfriend to soft rock and it's all very pathetic. And you know, I have my own things about that as a man who was quite happy to go to those kind of churches and what did it say about my masculinity. But I find it fascinating that just a few decades later, now the church is a refuge for people looking for a more rugged, masculine, gritty, disciplined, self-sacrificial way of life. I wonder what your reflections on that. Has the church changed, or are there different churches?
I've got some sympathy for that. I do think that the whole kind of feminization of the church thing has been overplayed sometimes. And the reality is there are other reasons why, in a very secularizing kind of context, women have sort of remained faithful where men have fallen away to some extent. I had an interesting conversation with Lucy Pepiat about this, who just said women are quite often more tolerant and able to put up with bad worship, basically, than men are. And there's a kind of sense in which, you know, it may be about just raising the quality of our worship altogether that is the key to seeing both men and women thrive in church, and not necessarily because of any, you know, Jesus is my boyfriend type thing. I think, generally speaking, there's been a shallowness, actually, to certain parts of the evangelical subculture that are bad for both men and women. And to that extent, I'm all in favour of kind of solid theology and good, you know, sort of stuff that you can get your teeth into, kind of sermons that aren't just about living your best life, but where you take seriously the intellectual tradition of Christianity and everything else. I find, especially men, for whatever reason, respond really well to that. And there's a kind of a really good, you know, precedent for doing that. I think, you know, I've been involved in the world of apologetics, and, you know, it's just a fact that that appeals, for whatever reason, to men far more than women on average. You know, when I would put on Unbelievable conferences back in the day, you know, 90% of the attendees would be men, when in churches, you know, they're only a third of the population, you know, the congregation. So there's definitely something about making sure that we serve the needs of the way men are wired on average, and don't sort of but at the same time, I don't want to kind of, too many people, I think, set it up as a sort of dichotomy between men and women. I think actually a lot of the things that will help men to flourish in church are the same things that will help women to flourish in church. I don't know if either of you have ever listened to my somewhat infamous conversation with Mark Driscoll along these lines many years ago, where we got into a bit of a spat about the fact my wife is a church leader and he didn't like that. But I would say, you know, I'm in a church which is led by a woman, my wife, but we have a really, I think, strong sort of set of principles in the way we do worship and think through things. That means we've got a very, you know, we appeal equally to men and women. We don't have this huge sort of gender imbalance. And I think that's important for churches to just get to work at trying to get that right. And I'm just glad that the conditions in culture seem to be changing to allow men to feel more comfortable stepping into a church tradition. And that's to be welcomed, but it shouldn't be somehow at the exclusion of women. And that's the other sort of slight danger that we're running into, is we're seeing more men coming to church. Some polls are saying, and less women are turning up at church because it suddenly feels like a kind of masculine space. Well, there's a problem there if either it feels too masculine or too feminine or whatever. There has to be some way in which Jesus speaks to both equally, you know, in that way.
No, absolutely right. And I think that the vision of the New Testament church is this kind of radical community that unites young and old, Jew and Greek, slave and free, and men and women. And any like true kingdom shaped church has to be diverse, I think, in terms of gender. Otherwise, you're missing something. And I mean, maybe I'm biased. I too am married to a church minister, but I always found the conversation about the supposed feminization of church a slightly reductionist or frustrating one, because it didn't seem to grapple with, as you say, the faithfulness of women in continuing to serve. It was always the women's fault why the men weren't coming, when actually I've been in countless congregations where there are lots of couples where the wife brings the children faithfully week after week after week, and it's the man who has excuses or reasons why church doesn't work for them, or they're too busy, or there's something else more important. So I think that question can often be turned around and say to the other direction and asked a question to men, rather than saying women have kind of rendered church an inhospitable space for men.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that possibly women are more tolerant as a for really not particularly inspiring church events. Certainly, going back to ancient history, I can remember when I was a teenager that I was very suspicious of the sort of heavily middle class bourgeois Christianity. And what, as a young man, I was looking for was something that was really challenging. And it was particularly Operation Mobilization, George Verwer, and that whole thing about, you know, sacrifice. If you want to follow Christ, it means sacrifice, it means hardship, it means challenge, it means, you know, giving up everything else for the sake of this one thing. And that really resonated with me and led to me spending summers, you know, with Operation Mobilization and traveling to, you know, many places across Europe. And I read books called True Discipleship, and it was, you know, this constant theme. And I don't feel that about, you know, I've often wondered if I was a 15-year-old growing up today, would I be saying, I really want to go to church? Because that challenge. Now, it's not that I think women need that challenge as well. But it has in general our evangelical church become so conventional, so bourgeois, predictable.
Yeah. No, I think that is the thing. And you know, I think there's something in that sort of that John Eldridge kind of formulation. Again, it can be turned into a caricature and an unhelpful one, but I think at its best, there's a sense in which, you know, you do want to hold out to men, you know, a sense of challenge, adventure, risk. You know, it kind of, I think it does inspire a lot of men. Let's not say it doesn't inspire women, but I think that it's particularly sort of whatever it is in the male psyche, there's sort of something about wanting to kind of to be, you know, some you know, at the center of your own story and to make an impact and make a difference. I think so many men live that out in some way, but often not in church. They live it out in their career. They live it out in their sportsmanship. They live it out in their whatever. When actually Christ is calling for that passion, that kind of very natural instinct that perhaps exists there, to be lived out for him. And I think calling men to that is not wrong. And it shouldn't, as long as it's not done at the expense of women. I think as long as we see that there is this kind of mutual flourishing that Christ calls us to in our diversity, and that, of course, you're going to always find, you know, I am not myself one of those kind of chest beating, you know.
You surprised
truck.
Me.
Join the club.
Monster truck driving football fans. You know, it's not my thing. But there is still lots of ways in which I would say I kind of, I'm different to my wife, and that's fine because we're all made to be different. Things that kind of, I think, are somewhat unique to the male experience, and you can't just flatten out the differences. But we're all still sort of, you know, varied as well, you know, men and women, and you can't kind of put anyone in a very specific box. That would be the alternative mistake to make. But let's not pretend that you reach every man and woman in exactly the same way. There's kind of going to be some things that, on average, for men, there are good ways of engaging them with the gospel and the challenge of Christianity and discipleship and so on.
Okay, one final question. We talked a bit about how churches can respond to these kind of new wave of people, particularly young people coming into their church, whether it's from a Jordan Peterson podcast or something like that. But do you think that we should take that one step further and say there is now a call on the church to step out in evangelism into these spaces or to utilize these arguments? You know, should we be sending out our apologists onto the forums and to deliberately try and use the argument about, you know, being a bulwark against radical Islam or something like that in the way that maybe Paul, you know, grabbed in the Areopagus with some kind of pagan poetry and art and said, actually, this is a bridge for me to communicate the gospel. Should we be taking into that kind of unfamiliar territory and going out to say, oh, you're looking for meaning and stability and challenge and discipline? Well, have you thought about Christianity, which is not a normal kind of variant of Christian evangelism?
Well, I think both that we should and that actually quite a lot of people are. You know, it's happening quite organically in a way. That's exactly what my Surprising Rebirth podcast was attempting to do, was to say something interesting is happening. There's all these people waking up to the value of faith, having these intellectual conversations about it, and it's trickling down, it would appear, to the man and woman on the street. Let me kind of bring that story to you and show you why the thing that it really is pointed to is Christ and the way in which he answers these deep longings and so on. So yeah, I'd say that's always, you know, but that in a sense is exactly, yeah, what Paul did on the Areopagus. It's what we need to be doing in our time. Our platform may not be the Mars Hill. It may be, you know, social media. It may be podcasts. It may be whatever. But absolutely, yeah, of course, Christians need to be on the front end of that. Never sort of, as it were, surrendering to, you know, someone else's agenda. You know, as I say, there's always this danger of the political aspect of it. Being very attuned to that and aware of that. But absolutely making the most of the opportunity that people are sensing a hunger, and they're looking for meaning, they're looking for purpose, they're looking for identity. And I'm very pleased to say, you know, I've always wanted to do, whether it was through Unbelievable or the shows I'm currently hosting, Uncommon Ground and Surprising Rebirth, is to create this overlap of the Christian secular world and to show the ways in which the Christian story answers the questions and longings of the secular world. And with the Surprising Rebirth podcast, you know, my thrill was always not when Christians got in touch to say this was really helpful for me to understand, but when agnostics and atheists and seekers got in touch to say this perfectly describes my journey, this has really helped me put the pieces together. So for me, that's absolutely the most fruitful mission ground that we need to be in, because there's this openness right now, and let's make the most of it.
Is there a risk that the gospel gets kind of captured by these outside forces, and in our desperation to kind of be relevant and engaging, we lose sight of the unchanging core truths?
Always, and that's always been the case with Christianity when we're, and let's not forget that can happen on both sides of the political spectrum. It can be captured by the left just as much as the right. But I would say, while that's a key concern, and we need to be very careful of it, we need to be very careful of the rise of Christian nationalism. You know, that's been on the headlines a lot. Let's also just be honest about the fact, as you said earlier, Tim, that God, you know, draws straight with crooked lines. There's going to be all kinds of mixed motives. I've often used the parable of the wheat and the tares. You know, that's become a helpful one for me, that you know, Christ tells this story of the farmer who goes and sows his seed in his field, but overnight an enemy comes and sows weeds among the good wheat, and as it starts to grow up, the servants say to him, oh, we can see these weeds, should we pull them up? He says, no, don't pull them up, because you might pull up the good stuff with them as well. Let's just wait for it all to grow up together, and then when we harvest it, we'll sort out the good from the bad. And I think it's a bit like that. Like, a lot of people have kind of been really critical of the Surprising Rebirth thesis, because they say, it's just all this political stuff, Justin. You know, there is political stuff. Of course there is. But there's also good stuff. There's also genuine spiritual hunger that's being manifest here. And so why don't we, rather than prejudging it, sort of be very wise, obviously, but also kind of let God be the judge ultimately of the ways in which, all the crooked ways in which people come to him, and be the ultimate judge, the sifting of the good and the bad. We just have to try and do faithfully what Christ calls us to do, which is, you know, to be ready for the harvest and to be people who follow his example and don't get sidetracked by any other concerns.
Yeah, I totally resonate with that. I agree, also feel that that parable is one of Jesus' most mysterious parables, isn't it? And yet it's one of the most relevant, I think. Mm. And of course, if you look back in church history over 2,000 years, that's what you see. You see the wheat and the weeds. You see, you know, revivals breaking out. You see the Reformation. You see, and then at the same time, you know, terrible evil suddenly. Mm. And you say, well, which bit was God and which bit was just secularism and which bit was nationalism and which bit was Christendom? And ultimately, that's beyond our pay grade. Mm. I think it's only at the end of the age that it will become clear. In the meantime, somehow, we pray for discernment. We pray for to blow with the wind of the Spirit. But discernment to see where it's going wrong, where really unhealthy stuff is being smuggled in.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm glad, though, overall, as much as there are all these sort of important concerns and considerations, I do sense a sense of optimism in the church that I haven't seen for a long time. And that's, I've been very glad to sort of be able to be part of that story, that it feels like something's changed. You know, there's this openness that's going to represent all kinds of challenges as we meet all the meaning seekers with all their confused and, you know, lives and perspectives coming in. But I'd rather they were coming in than not coming in. Do you know what I mean? And we've just got to be ready for that. We've got to try and be faithful in responding as best we can to whatever this is. It might not be a long term revival. I don't know what this, whether this is just another blip, you know, like the one after the Second World War. But it's a moment where I think Christ is calling us to respond faithfully to the people who are looking again.
Hmm. Well, that seems like a good place to draw our conversation to a close. Thank you so much, Justin. It's been brilliant talking some of these issues through with you. Just give us a quick reminder of where people can find some of your work if they want to follow up these ideas.
Thank you. JustinBrierley.com is my website. You can get hold of my newsletter there to be kept up to date with everything that we're doing. You can find the most recent podcasts and videos that I'm involved in, the Surprising Rebirth podcast that I've mentioned a few times, plus the book and my other works. But Uncommon Ground is also something folks might be interested in, a new show that's really aimed at having really good conversations on faith, culture, history, science, and so on, with genuine mutual understanding. So again, all of that's available at justinbrierley.com.
Fantastic. And as always, we like to point people to Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Lots of resources to read and listen and watch, listen to and watch. And also, if you want some church news journalism, if that's your thing, you can come to my website, which is tswyatt.com, and particularly my weekly newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up to for free through there. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Justin. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.